As for science versus religion, I'm issuing a restraining order. Religion must stay 500 yards from science at all times.
You have the right to remain an attorney.
Did you say that you have the right to be an attorney?
You do have the right to be an attorney if you want to.
It seems absurd to instruct you again that you must tell the truth while you testify, yet here I am. You must tell the truth while you testify.
I'm not a pirate. So happens, I am a lawyer.
Kill the lawyer!
Kill the lawyer!
I'm not that kind of lawyer.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 680. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew Torres, Esquire. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. I just hope they find the real murderer. I think the Supreme Court and OJ are going to be looking to track down the real leaker and the real murderer.
Ooh.
Hopefully they keep one day keep at it. One day they'll find who really leaked the thing. No, we're just, people know we record on Thursdays, and in between recordings here, we got the news that SCOTUS is like, we can't figure it out. Don't know. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so let's talk about all of that, because I think this deserves more than just kind of a passing moment as to just how egregious this is. So, to kind of set the stage, Samuel Alito wrote the majority opinion in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health, the case that overturned Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Several months previously, a draft of that opinion was released. And Chief Justice Roberts vowed again, like the fugitive, to visit every outhouse, doghouse, courthouse, and would not rest until the leaker was brought to justice. I want to add onto that before we start talking about it, that I'm going to include this link in the show notes. On October 26th of this year at a Heritage Foundation event, Samuel Alito said that the release of his draft opinion, quote, made the justices presumed to be in the majority targets for assassination because it gave people a rational reason to think they could prevent that from happening by killing one of us. End of goddamn quote. Quote, it was a grave betrayal of trust by somebody, said Samuel Alito. Now, one of the things that we have learned since then, in fact, just about a month, 3 weeks after that, I'm shocked to find gambling going on in this establishment. Bullshit statement by Samuel Alito to the bullshit American Heritage Foundation. We had a bombshell reporting in the New York Times by Jody Cantor and Joe Becker that, in fact, Samuel Alito had leaked the draft opinion of his decision in 2014 in the Hobby Lobby case to a person then affiliated with the religious right, the Reverend Rob Schenck. That included a letter that Schenck sent to the Supreme Court in connection with his, I vow to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, as in like, hey, might have some info for you. If you're looking for leakers, let me tell you a story about this one time.
Let me tell you a story about this one time when Samuel Alito wrote an opinion that was super favorable to everything the religious right had wanted for decades. In fact, let me not put words in the Reverend's mouth, Reverend Schenck, who I think is now kind of backed away from the most conservative aspects of the religious right. I don't know and don't really care, sort of where he is theologically, politically. He says, quote, back in June 2014, when so many awaited the court's decision in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, indeed they did, I was informed by a donor to the Capitol Hill-based nonprofit organization that I led that she and her husband would be dining at the home of Justice and Mrs. Alito. She suggested that in their table conversation, she might be able to learn the status of the case, something she knew I had an interest in knowing. I received a follow-up message from her notifying she had indeed obtained the information during that visit. We spoke on the phone. She detailed the revelation. as I recall, we talked about the Green family, that was the bullshit plaintiffs, owners of Hobby Lobby, and how they too would be interested in this information. Yeah, you think? Over the ensuing 3 weeks, I kept the sensitive information to myself, undetectably using it to assist me in preparing for the inevitable announcement. That's a really important sentence, right? Like, because we've talked about, like, you know, was this leaked by someone on the left to cause outrage or whatever? But we have seen the level of coordination between right-wing activist sources, and knowing in advance that an opinion is coming out in your favor helps you prepare for how you take advantage of the press when that opinion comes out. Then a day or two before the opinion was released, I called Mr. Steve Green, again, remember, the CEO of Hobby Lobby, and reported what I knew of the court's finding. He thanked me, and we did not speak about it again until after October of that year. Considering there may be a severe penalty to be paid by whoever is responsible for the initial leak of the recent draft opinion, that is now going back to Dobbs, I thought this previous incident might bear some consideration by you and others involved in the process. I would be happy to fully cooperate should you find any value in any other details surrounding what I've transmitted here. Now, I want to add, before we talk about what John Roberts published today, I want to kind of talk about the appointment of Richard Herr as special counsel and, you know, in general, talking about avoiding the appearance of impropriety, something that John Roberts, as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, writes on every single year in his status of the Supreme Court, right? And laments. We've called him an institutionalist, and we've talked about how he really, really wants to restore, you know, integrity and honor to the Supreme Court. It's all a very notable, noteworthy thing. And one of the things that you do, if you care about the court's perception, I would think, is you would want to have, if you're conducting an investigation into what is almost certainly Samuel goddamn Alito, you might want to have that appear to be as above board as possible, right?
Andrew, I want to stop you right there. We need, as skeptics, we got to be open-minded. It could have been one of the other right-wing crap bags on the Supreme Court, just because Alito is the only one who had somebody who was affiliated with the right and then maybe thought better of it enough to be a whistleblower about this. Just because that's Sam Alito's kind of bad luck doesn't mean Justice Thomas isn't doing this all the time, but just nobody's tattling on him. So it could still not be Sam Alito. Just make that very clear.
It could be, but knowing that you are doing this after there has been a very public report about Samuel Alito, and the reason I'm focusing on Alito will become clear in about 8 seconds, you might want to say, rely on someone who is not the political appointee of the president who appointed Samuel Alito. You might want, right, Richard Herr is a Republican. You might maybe want to get a Democrat to investigate into the source of the, but not if you're John Roberts. If you're John Roberts, you consulted Michael Chertoff, George W. Bush's Secretary of Homeland Security, a veteran from the Ken Starr special prosecutor investigation of Whitewater. In fact, when Michael Chertoff was nominated by George W. Bush to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, that vote was unanimous with one dissent. That one dissent was Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton said very specifically, that was 88-1, so, you know, 11 non-voting, one opposition, and Hillary Clinton said that she had dissented. She voted against Chertoff to, quote, register her protest for the way Chertoff's staff mistreated junior White House staffers during the Whitewater investigation, end of quote. That is taken directly from Michael Chertoff's Wikipedia page. The footnote there is footnote 9, which points to Lizzie Ratner's article in the New York Observer, Hillary's nemesis, mean Mike Chertoff, is up for Homeland. Okay, so this is somebody who is political appointee, hostile to Hillary Clinton and to the Clintons, was on the Whitewater investigation. And by the way, George W. Bush is the president who appointed Samuel Alito to the bench. So yeah, this then attaches a statement from Michael Chertoff. He was asked by the Chief Justice to independently review and assess the thoroughness of the investigation into the draft Dobbs opinion leak. And I can't find anybody. I don't know. There's nothing in my mind that could absolutely help in trying to figure out who could have possibly leaked this. And if you're asking, does it mention Samuel Alito? No. the statement does not, like, again, before we delve into, so this is just so that we are clear on the structure of this. This is a 1.5-page statement by the court, and it is described as statement of the court concerning the leak investigation. It is not signed by John Roberts, but I imagine that it was authored by John Roberts because that's the person who articulated that he would begin such an investigation. And then after that 1.5 pages, it has a 21-page summary of findings from Michael Chertoff. And Michael Chertoff, that begins by saying, I was asked by the Chief Justice to independently review and assess the thoroughness of the investigation into the Dobbs draft opinion leak and to identify any useful investigative measures as well as any actions that would improve the handling of sensitive documents in the future. So now I'm going to go back to how does Roberts characterize this? He says, we invited Mr. Chertoff to assess the marshal's investigation. He advised that the marshal undertook a thorough investigation and, quote, at this time, I cannot identify any additional useful investigative measures not already undertaken or underway, end of quote.
Hmm.
So you might then say, okay, maybe this guy's got his thumb on the scale for Alito, but he certainly has considered and evaluated the fact that a whistleblower has come forward and publicly explained that Samuel Alito did this only 8 years previously, right? With another one of his draft opinions, which helps explain, hey, how'd you get a copy of this? Oh, look, I got a copy of it from the guy who wrote it off of his hard drive. You would be wrong in thinking that, you know, you sweet summer child. The word, the name Alito is not present in the entirety of this 21-page report or in the court's 1.5-page summary. Nothing. There's no indication at all that the supposed outside consultant or the court's marshal engaged in any way whatsoever with the obvious allegation of this exact same behavior having taken place 8 years prior. And it's just gross.
It really
there's
is infuriating.
Nothing else you can say. You know, and then there's some like, assuming that the opinion was intentionally provided to Politico by a court employee, that individual was evidently able to act without being detected by any of the court's IT systems. And right.
So is it Tom Cruise?
Yeah. I'm not a prized member of the Chertoff group that is capable of undertaking sensitive government investigations, but maybe Sam Alito has a laptop. Maybe he's got a personal computer that he sometimes works on stuff from home as exacerbated by the pandemic, right? Like, it's just like, wow, it's a complete mystery, as you point out, you know, Tom Cruise, right? Like, it's how could this get in or out? We have no idea.
You've driven Andrew insane, court. You're making him do a bunch of voices and stuff. That should be a sign that you've gone too far.
Yeah, you have gone too far. It's just,
yeah, it really is hard to take. Like the very people who lecture us on the sanctity of the court and the blah blah blah, and they just don't give a shit. I imagine he just was like, well, Alito said he didn't, so I'm not obviously not gonna look
it
into
it
that.
Does not even say that, right? That is the minimum level of,
yeah, that's, I'm saying that's the thinking that has to go into not even looking into it.
A minimally competent, unbiased observer would, you know, maybe ask. Like, look, you could make an argument, and I'm struggling here, right? Because this is just so egregious. I am struggling to think. You could say, hey, look, just because there was virtually identical behavior 8 years ago, right? That's the kind of, you know, past behavior that we would, you know, carjacker Willie
as a draft leaker.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, how dare you think that I did the exact same thing again? But like, go through the motions of making the argument. At least talk about, you have somebody who came forward as a whistleblower who wrote a letter to the court in July of 2022, and his name is not, you padded this out to 23 pages, and you don't mention him by name. You don't discuss the most relevant potential piece of information. Somebody saying like, hey, don't know anything about, you know, your particular document, but if you're wondering, like, does somebody have a history of sticking their hand in the cookie jar? You know, here's a case in which somebody gave me a handful of cookies.
Yeah,
right?
Here's like, a cookie, and it's got Alito's disgusting germs all over it.
Yeah. So, again, bunch of takeaways here, but, you know, just remember, as we continue to move into this sort of brave new world of John Roberts is not considered a member of the Howler Monkey contingent. And I don't think he should be, right? Like, there are distinctions between John Roberts' judicial philosophy and Samuel Alito's. Remember that in virtually everything, he's happy to empower and provide cover for the Howler Monkey contingent. And I have zero proof on this, but I think that what actually happened was that Roberts was actually upset about the leak. And then once it became clear to him, like, oh yeah, that's your boy who did that, you know, it became, well, I'm not that.
We will not stop until we root out this some months later. Did I say that? Did I say we're going to look into that? Well, we did. We looked. It's over. We can't find it.
It was a grave assault on the judicial process. It was one of the worst breaches of trust in the court's history.
Yeah, it's like Tommy Lee Jones 20 minutes after that speech in The Fugitive being like, I tried. I looked 10 feet from the train crash. Remember how I said I was going to do every outhouse, henhouse? Turns out there's a lot of outhouses and henhouses. I did that too hard. I quit.
Mike Chertoff thinks he cannot think of a single person whom you might want to, you know, interview or investigate or follow up. And so, good enough for us. Unbelievable.
Well, he did say, okay, I want to ask you this. He did say that's not already being undertaken. Is there some wiggle room here of like, well, there's still a double secret investigation going on currently or something? Because the language seemed to imply that stuff could be currently being looked into.
It could, except that the Marshall's report is dated as of the date that we're recording this, right? Thursday, January 19th, 2023. And so, you know, that has wrapped it up, right? The Marshall's done.
Oh,
and then they delivered that to Mike Chertoff. Yeah, it says to identify any useful investigative measures. I love this because in real time, you have uncovered another bit of perfidiousness by Chief Justice John Roberts, who, again, is the presumed author of the 1.5 pages that the court appends to the beginning, because that not already undertaken or underway language is language added by Roberts to what Chertoff said. Here's what Chertoff said. Chertoff said, my review assessed that the marshal and her experienced investigators undertook a thorough investigation within their legal authorities, and while there is not sufficient evidence at present for prosecution or other legal action, there were important insights gleaned from that investigation that can be acted upon to avoid future incidents. End of quote.
Hmm.
And then in the next paragraph, it says, throughout my review, there's blah, 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 talking about interviewed. Throughout my review, the investigators were transparent, cooperative, and available to answer my questions about the process. At this time, I cannot identify any additional useful investigative measures, period, end of quote. So Chertoff says, yeah, investigators finished. Yeah, they did a bang up hell of a job, answered all my questions. Great work. Is there anything else they could have done? No, I cannot think of a single thing that they could do. And then Roberts appends on not already undertaken or underway, which implies that there's more stuff going on that, as far as we know, there are not.
Now this I'm confused if I misunderstood. So this guy was investigating the investigators. He's watching the watchman. But then is there room for those investigators to still be doing anything? Or did
they've delivered their final report to him. Yes. It says Marshall's report of findings and recommendations. That's the Supreme Court marshals who did the actual investigation. Yes.
Huh. Well, then why? Yeah, currently under. That is a weird thing for him to have added.
It's a deliberately misleading thing to have said, and you picked up on it, and I did not when I initially read.
Unless he's still letting his kid like look into it. We still have some investigations going. Like my kids love this show Mira. It's all about investigating, and they have their little magnifying glasses. I bought them magnifying glasses so they could pretend they're detectives. Maybe they're on the case, you know. And then that's what. So there's still things underway. You never know.
Got it. I highly recommend Blue's Clues reruns. Alex loved Blue's Clues. So. But yeah, be it Mira or Blue's Clues, that would be the only kind of investigation that's still going on right now. And that would be way more thorough than anything the marshals or Michael Chertoff did in connection with this.
Well, okay, we get that this Michael Chiklis, this Chertoff guy, Chiklis would have gotten, he would have made Alito squeal. I get that guy's a partisan hack, but Are the court martial? Who are those people? Are they? I don't know if we talked about that at the time. Are they just policey people? Like who? Why would they have not done their due diligence in asking a single question to Alito?
Great question. Two answers to that. Number one, I don't know. Number two, the marshal was specifically tasked by Chief Justice Roberts with investigating the public disclosure of the draft majority opinion. This is a, you know, rather like, remember how the House clerk had to preside over the House of Representatives for the 3 days until we had a Speaker of the House, and that's just a non-political career person. And, you know, there were like some criticisms left and right, but basically, like, this is somebody who is not, you know, a political part of the process, but is just, you know, a career appointee kind of doing their job. And so if you would ask, hey, is there a reason why a staffer might not want to point the fingers at a sitting Supreme Court justice? I could think of a bunch of those. I know evidence for it, but I could think of a bunch of reasons why that might not be the case. In other words,
the question. So this person is just really bad at their job then.
I think there's no way, and this is the entire reason why you would want to have hired someone other than Michael Chertoff, because when you look at the section, right, conduct of the investigation, it says, in the initial phase, this is the marshal describing what they did. In the initial phase, investigators sought to gain an understanding of the details of the opinion circulation process, the court's policies and training addressing confidentiality, laws that were potentially violated by any unauthorized disclosure, and IT policies in place concerning the handling of sensitive information. Investigators preserved, collected, and reviewed any forensic information that could be found on the court's IT systems and conducted formal interviews with court personnel. The investigative team also enlisted external technical assistance when necessary to examine specific items of evidence. So let me translate that into human being for you. What this is saying is that the marshal's office, in conducting their investigation, looked at, hey, did Tom Cruise descend from the ceiling and hack into our computers? Did a clerk go rogue, either a Supreme Court clerk or somebody who just happens to work in the Supreme Court? Was there a hack? Was there a breach? Was there, right?
But the call was coming from inside the house.
Right. That was not part of the question that they asked. And so if you had handed this over to, say, the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, we would have told John Roberts, hey, nothing against your investigative team assembled by the marshal here. Just like Mike, we think they did a bang up job and the stuff that they were tasked with doing. But they didn't seem to be tasked with doing the thing that you said publicly you wanted them to do, which was find out who leaked this document, because they pursued one avenue of potential leaked information, right? Did a low-level staffer exceed their authority, go rogue? Did, you know, somebody hack into the systems? And yeah, bang up job. The investigators did not find any logs or IT artifacts indicating that the draft opinion was downloaded to removable media, but it is impossible to rule out. Yeah, sure. Right. Great. They didn't talk to any of the justices, despite having had a credible whistleblower present an account of the exact same thing 8 years previously. They did not so much as follow up with that person or with the justice who was implicated in that story. And that seems irresponsible.
Nuts. There's way too much respect for Supreme Court justices. There needs to be less, just as a rule. All right. Well, that sucks.
It sure does.
Hate that. Now for our planned show, because that was just based on you seeing this and somehow digesting all that instantly. We have more on Raynal from last week, the sanctioned guy who's sanctioned twice in Texas, but perhaps not sanctioned in Connecticut. What's going on there?
That's right. A couple days later, this is slightly different grounds. Remember that on Friday, we discussed how F. Andino Raynal, McMullet to some, to his friends, I like to think, was sanctioned twice by the Texas court for his role in orchestrating, collaborating with, and providing misleading and false statements to both plaintiff's counsel and the court regarding the sham InfoWars bankruptcy that was orchestrated in order to throw a monkey wrench into the court's trial schedule, which it succeeded in doing so. And it contained the delightful provision permissible under Texas law that was like, hey, man, if you appeal this, I'm just saying in advance, I'm letting you know I'm granting the plaintiffs their additional sanctions for any costs they incur in that appeal, assuming that you lose. So that was delightful. Then the question was, F. Andino Reynal sanctions, right? Remember, we're minting our sanctions NFTs. We're long on sanctions as a commodity. Was also the subject of a pending show cause order in the Connecticut case. That is the Lafferty plaintiffs, where Norm Pattiz succeeded in, you know, losing Alex Jones $1.5 billion. And in that case, the question was, should Reynal be sanctioned in connection with the leak of the Alex Jones hard drive? And in particular, should he be sanctioned in Connecticut for that? And remember, Texas was its own thing. And the issue of, did my assistant accidentally leave the link on? And, you know, nobody looked to see what these documents were. And by the way, they're responsive to a bunch of discovery requests that we lied and we told you we didn't have the data and, you know, all of that. That's independent. In Connecticut, the question was, remember that one of the appalling and gross things that were contained in the Alex Jones hard drive dump were confidential medical records that were pursued to try and show that the Connecticut plaintiffs were somehow unfit as plaintiffs, you know, investigations into their mental history, background, history of treatment, that sort of thing. And because those are medical records, you can't just go around showing those things to anybody. They are personal, confidential medical records. And F. Andino Reynal should not have had them. He was not subject to a joint disclosure, even though there is sharing of discovery, both by plaintiffs and by defense counsel between the two cases. You have to specify what it is that you're sharing. And when you share somebody's medical records, you have to tell the person whose medical records they are. And so when, for example, Mark Bankston, the plaintiff's lawyer in Texas, inadvertently received copies of the entire Alex Jones hard drive, in addition to cackling with glee and preparing for the greatest cross-examination in the history of Western civilization, the very first thing he did was call the plaintiff's lawyers in Connecticut and go, hey, there appear to be confidential medical records regarding your clients here, and I'm deleting those right now. And you tell me if you need me to do anything else to preserve your client's confidentiality. That's how you handle that. When you get something that doesn't belong to you that contains top secret, confidential, highly sensitive medical information, you call the lawyers for that party and you go, oh my gosh, I have this. How do you want me to dispose of this? What do you want me to do?
Yeah.
Reynal never did that. He never deleted it. And in fact, you know, he enabled multiple parties down the line to potentially have access to that. And so that was really the gravamen of the claim against Reynal in Connecticut. And I told you that the court ultimately declined to impose sanctions on Reynal in connection with that particular disclosure. It's a 46-page opinion. And if you're thinking, shouldn't really require 46 pages to say, no, you're fine, buddy.
Yeah.
That's because it doesn't say that. That's because it says at great length the improper behavior that Reynal engaged in. And then it says, we want to take a look at mitigating factors. Mitigating factors are, you got no history of any sanctions against you. You've got no history of, you know, sort of any kind of black marks. This is a discovery thing, and you were the 10th lawyer to be engaged by Alex Jones in this case. And it was a super mess. And we get it that, like, it bounced around like a pinball from A to B to C to D to E to F. And, you know, you were pretty careless with this. But at the end of the day, it's probably attenuated enough that the significant list of good credits right? Mitigating factors counts in your favor. So, you know, I'll say that briefly. This is, I'm going to say a couple nice things via the court about F. Andino Reynal. Turning to mitigating factors, the respondent has no prior public disciplinary records. There's an absence of a dishonest or selfish motive. That's true, right? And that distinguishes you from, you know, Norm Pattis, who goes on InfoWars every couple of days. There's really not a sense that Reynal is personally benefiting from this, right? Like, he was hired to come in, do a job. He did that job. And, you know, there's no sort of personal motive to that. The court attributes some minimal credit for the respondent's late filing of the emergency motion for protective order, although that effort fell short. The court also assigns some minimal credit for remorse. The court does so because the respondent's remorse is tempered by his belief that plaintiff's counsel, Mark Bankston, was wrong for utilizing the other documents after the 10-day clawback period had ended. In fact, the only blame lies with respondent.
I like that they're judging his remorse. They're like the Olympics. Like, he did a remorse floor routine, and they're like, that's okay, I guess.
That's more of a 6.7.
Yeah.
Exactly. The court also acknowledges the respondent's responsiveness to the plaintiff's counsel, coupled with his expressions of embarrassment and indication that he was deeply troubled by the inadvertent disclosure. The court also credits as a mitigating factor good reputation or character based on the respondent's testimony that he had retained former Texas disciplinary counsel to assist him in assessing his discovery obligations in the Texas case, where he came in as the 10th attorney in that case. This court wholeheartedly agrees with the respondent's statement that both the bar and the bench should actively support lawyers reaching out to ethics lawyers to help them zealously advocate for their clients while staying within ethical boundaries. Fair point, right? And the court considered as a mitigating factor respondent's full and free disclosure and cooperative attitude towards these proceedings. The respondent appeared in person during the evidentiary hearing, having traveled from Texas voluntarily without being compelled to do so. Okay, all right. Yeah, you know, you got all that. This is how it ends. And again, this is not, well, I'll just read it to you. Having considered the aforementioned factors, this court is not imposing any sanctions despite its finding of misconduct on the part of the respondent. This disciplinary matter could easily have had a much different result. The respondent is reaping the benefit here of an impressive number of important mitigating factors that militate in his favor. The court orders, however, that should the respondent make any future pro hoc vice applications in the state of Connecticut, he must disclose this proceedings and attach a copy of this decision. So, look, at the end of the day, I think the Connecticut court is probably right here. Reynal never appeared in Connecticut. It's tough to say, you know, if they had imposed sanctions, what sanctions the Connecticut court could have imposed on him. He's never really under their jurisdiction. He could argue no, you know, contacts with Connecticut whatsoever. There are a bunch of arguments to the contrary that I'm sure Judge Bell has considered very thoroughly in deciding, at the end of the day, this is a close call. I'm not going to sanction you, but I am going to make sure that this follows you around, because you ever do something like this again, people should know about it. And it should, you know, once, okay, fine, maybe it was a mistake, but maybe don't represent people like Alex Jones in the future, and you won't be in this situation. Would I have liked to have seen, you know, the trifecta, you know, the hat trick against McMullen? Yeah, probably. He voluntarily represented Alex Jones when he didn't have to, and he participated in a bunch of stuff that was really, really shady. At the end of the day, the medical stuff here was he didn't look carefully at stuff sent to him by some of Alex Jones's even crappier lawyers. And then, you know, his paralegal left a link open. And if it were Thomas Smith here, right, I would probably be arguing for lenience. So I can't fault the court for not sanctioning Reynal here. But in asking, in the scheme of things, will it have consequences? This is, as your middle school teacher would say, a part of your permanent record now. So there you go.
And finally, final bullet point. It just says here, Andrew, Dersh is a lying liar who lies. Wow, another update in the Dersh lying and being a terrible lawyer. And what more could he have done?
And I will just give the link in the show notes, but I was reminded of this because a couple of days after we covered the Dersh sanctions Arizona, in which, in addition to giving as excuses, I'm old, I've had a bunch of strokes, it's my first day, the gravamen of his argument was, I should be listed as of counsel. Mm-hmm. And the reason I should be listed as of counsel and not counsel is because I was only ever engaged on the very, very narrow issue of evaluating this particular claim about state action as a function of federal constitutional law. Right? That was his main argument. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I was here to opine on the U.S. Constitution. I didn't look at any of the state issues. I don't even know what a state is. It might surprise you that in the final opinion from the Arizona Court of Appeals, that's the Arizona Intermediate Appellate Court, in Arizona Party and Kelly Ward versus everybody in existence, right? This is the Kelly Ward case, that listed as counsel on page one is Harvard Law School by Alan Dershowitz, pro hoc vice counsel for plaintiff's appellants, Arizona Republican Party, and Kelly Ward. And this is entirely a state law question. Right? This is the question about early voting. The Superior Court found Arizona's mail-in voting laws adequately preserve secrecy in voting, denied plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction, and entered a final judgment dismissing plaintiff's complaint. Plaintiffs appealed. And then the appellate court says, because the Superior Court did not err in finding Arizona's mail-in voting laws preserve secrecy in voting, we affirm. And to be clear, that allegation that they made in this case, the Kelly Ward, for which Alan Dershowitz is listed as counsel on page one, not of counsel, you know, not some kind of bizarre, I'm only dealing with the federal constitution, was the Arizona's mail-in voting violates Article 7, Section 1 of the Arizona Constitution, which is not present.
Is the Arizona the one that the founding fathers did for our whole country?
Yeah.
Is that the one? I'm bad at history. Which one is that? Or is that the Arizona state one?
It's the Arizona state one. And in fact, like, no language like this is in the Constitution. It says, quote, all elections by the people shall be by ballot, comma, or by such other method as may be prescribed by law, provided that secrecy in voting shall be preserved, end of quote. It's been litigated a bunch of times in Arizona. It's known as the secrecy clause. There's no secrecy clause in the U.S. Constitution. So Alan Dershowitz engaged by the same set of plaintiffs in connection with voting issues in Arizona, under which the sole claim is an Arizona state constitutional claim, not a U.S. constitutional claim. Yeah. So if you were wondering, is Alan Dershowitz a lying sack of crap? Alan Dershowitz is a lying sack of crap.
We weren't wondering because we've already done this same segment 100 times, and this is not a criticism. Each time I'm like, well, Andrew, you've already poked so many holes in Dersh's defense. It's actually a wormhole to the center of the different dimension because you poked so many holes in this defense. It's some weird new phase of matter, but there's still more. Like, there's somehow always still more. Now, my question is procedurally, was this a little bit of a leftover magic from last time, or was this another filing thing? Like, How were you made aware of this additional lie, like the 1900th lie?
Because this decision was handed down by the Arizona Appellate Court a few days after, and again, in a parallel case, a few days after Alan Dershowitz filed his sanctions reply that we broke down. So I just thought it was worth pointing out.
No, definitely. It's funny to me because from my perspective, it's like, geez, it keeps coming up. And it feels like this is some content drip that you're doing. Like this all, like this all came out a month ago and you're just like, let's see how much we can make. Nope. It's literally you're reporting on it as it happens, and his lies just keep unraveling additionally every week.
Because when you, and again, don't take lying advice from this podcast either, but like when you engage in ad hoc lies, it's really super easy to expose those, right? And so Dershowitz came up with this inane idea of, well, I'm just here for the U.S. constitutional stuff, and the court does not care. We've been through in our three previous episodes on this, right? This isn't going to help you anyway, but it's such a bad lie that it's also, you know, instantly provably false.
Yeah.
Because there his name is challenging Arizona's substantive voting law as violating the Arizona state constitution. And you know, what a piece of crap. It's just, and it hurts. It really still does. So yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of one of my favorite Mark Twain quotes, which is just, if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. Right. I've always, this web of lies. Clearly, again, he may say in his defense, he's too old to remember all his lies. That may be the next level of defense. Sorry, I can't keep all of them straight. I'm old. I don't know.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam. No kidding.
All right, now it's time for GPT-3BE. This is iteration 3. I'm 2-0 against this robot. I'm just knocking the crap out of this thing. Let's see if I can keep that impossible streak alive.
All right, Thomas. During examination in chief, a plaintiff's lawyer seeks to show the plaintiff's witness 8 text messages the witness sent to a relation in another state an hour after a hurricane struck the witness's town. May the lawyer do so? A, yes, because the witness is dodging the lawyer's questions. B, yes, because the witness cannot remember what she texted. C, yes, because it is relevant for cross-examination. Or D, yes, because the witness is considered hostile.
Oh, wow. I love this. Because it's all, none of those are in the facts. It's just, I have to, it's basically come up with a reason why this would make sense, which those are always a challenge. I'm very curious to see how GPT does with this. But of course, I have to go first. I can't get any help. All right. Okay, so this is as a non-practicing attorney, I'm only ever of counsel. I never really get involved in these things. So this is something that I imagine if you practice law every day, you're like, yeah, this all makes sense, but I got to pay attention to these details. So this is examination in chief. So this is not cross-examination. This is the plaintiff's lawyer seeks to show the plaintiff's witness text messages. And it doesn't say anything about like admitting them into evidence per se. Now, I know we've talked about before the like refresher notes or whatever. Like, can you, there's something about that. Oh man, I'm probably not going to remember like exactly how that went, which sucks. But I know we've talked about, hey, refresh yourself on these notes. And then there's the thing where like, if you do that, then I think the other side gets to look at the notes or something like that. I don't know if that'll apply here. So basically, maybe the plaintiff's witness is testifying about these messages and then the plaintiff's lawyer. So this is all on the plaintiff's side. This is not a, you know, the other side or cross-examination. Plaintiff's lawyer wants to show that witness 8 text messages sent. May the lawyer do so. Yes, because the witness is dodging the lawyer's questions. That doesn't sound right at all. I think A is a pretty easy elimination. This is one where I actually feel like ChatGPT might win. We'll see. B, yes, because the witness cannot remember what she texted. Okay. That seems like an attractive answer, just setting everything else aside. It seems like the movie answer, and maybe that means it's right. Maybe that means it's wrong. I don't know, but it's like, oh, do you remember sending these text messages? And what did they say? And then the witness says, I don't remember. I'm sorry. And then the person says, let me refresh your memory. Let's show you the text messages. Can you do that? I mean, I know that Andrew's talked about doing the thing where you share the deposition. Like, oh, were you lying then or are you lying now? Here's what you said in deposition. But this is not quite like that, I don't think. All right. C, yes, because it is relevant for cross-examination. Now, that's terrible. It's not C. D, yes, because the witness is considered hostile. So D seems all wrong, but I'm leaving open the possibility that D is the extreme trick answer. Then again, D is a little too much like A, because A is yes, because the witness is dodging the lawyer's questions. So even if I was going to go the trick route, which is, you know, it'd be a pretty tricky answer to be like, yes, because the witness is considered hostile. You know, like if this rule is you can only do this to a hostile witness, which I'm not even sure that's true, but let's say that's the trick answer. It's weird to think that D would be the answer and not A. Yes, because the witness is dodging the lawyer's questions. I mean, they're too similar, I guess. And often when they're too similar, I feel like it's neither of them because there's just not enough to distinguish between them. I mean, I think it's just got to be B. Yes, because the witness cannot remember what she texted. I really don't like any of the other answers. Let me try to see what my second choice would be. Relevant for cross-examination. That can't be right. You don't have to set up cross-ex for the other side. Like, is there anything you want me to bring up so that you can cross-examine my witness better? I really don't think that could possibly be it. Am I misunderstanding? A plaintiff's lawyer seeks to show the plaintiff's witness. Yeah, no, that's all on the same side, right? Am I crazy? What am I missing here? And then yes, because the witness, I will say D is probably still my second favorite answer. So I'm between B and D, but pretty strongly B because I don't like any of the other answers. So with that said, I think we better see how ChatGPT does on this question. Let's see. All right. Well, I know I said this might be the one where it gets me, but let's see. This, as it was typing, I was reading it, doesn't seem promising. So ChatGPT says C, yes, because it is relevant for cross-examination. Their explanation is, during the examination in chief, the plaintiff's lawyer is trying to establish the plaintiff's case by presenting evidence and asking questions to the plaintiff's witness. If the text messages sent by the witness an hour after a hurricane struck their own town are relevant to the case and can help establish the plaintiff's case, the lawyer may show them to the witness during examination in chief. The lawyer may also use the text messages for cross-examination, which is the questioning of a witness by the opposing lawyer, in order to challenge the credibility or reliability of witness testimony. So that sounds terrible. This seems like the worst one yet, but, or am I wrong? Or did it get me? I missed something. So I said B, the chatbot said C. Answers are submitted hereby, thusly, whomst, I don't know. Done. End of thing. Go ahead, Andrew.
All right, if you want to play along with Thomas and ChatGPT, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media, include the hashtag T3BE, include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Enjoying all the goodies? The ad-free shows, the biggest benefit going these days. You know, if you invested in sanctions and ad-free shows early on and Bitcoin in like 2007 or something, you're just loaded by now. Those were very good investments. All right. Thank you to disciplinary lawyer from a troubled theocratic border province, Charlie Spears, Austin Eck, Ride Thy Wubs, a Patreon of the Aughts, Clay, John Coogan, Tamara Rhodes, eat a bug, Mark Meadows. Weird.
I love that. Okay. That is so
Andrew's
funny.
Overburdened pincushion. Maro. Well, the pincushion itself has nothing in it, actually, because all the pins
they
are
all
everywhere
get pulled
else.
Out eventually,
the cushion,
yeah.
Pristine. Not a single pin in it. Maro Caligari, SV Loafer's Glory, Jim Bob Duggar's Liberal Conjoined Twin, Chris Rumble, David Kittle, Patrick Furlong, and Knack with a G. Your turn, Andrew.
And a big thank you to Sue. To everyone has the right to be stupid, but Abbott and Paxton abuse the privilege. Lewd Intentions, Ed Allard, Greg Eldridge, Jim Wood, P.E., Emily Pye, Victor Rothman, surfer, rugby player, lawyer, in that order. Chris Cruz, Robert Swift, Emily Hears, John Wickham, Eva Aries Detterding, CBH01, and Kevin. Thank you all so much for supporting the show over at patreon.com/law.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we'll see you all tomorrow for the regular Monday deep dive. Do we have a name for we get the Liz Die Wednesday usually. I guess this one's the orphan. We don't have a name for the Sunday one. Yeah. If anybody has a pithy name for it, let me know. But that's so far, that's the unnamed one. But we will see you tomorrow for Deep Dive Monday.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.